involved in that sort of thing again, Smith recalled. The Czech agent went to Prague without permission to use the brush pass, and a year went by. Smith hammered away at headquarters seeking approval. A steady stream of valuable agents was beginning to show up in Eastern Europe, and Smith felt the dead-drop routines were completely inadequate. In 1965, Helms agreed to an experiment. He sent his deputy, Thomas Karamasinas, to a demonstration of the brush pass. Smith set it up in the lobby of the grand old Mayflower Hotel in downtown Washington. In the demonstration, the brush pass was carried out so deftly that Karamasinas missed it. The key had been sleight of hand. A case officer dramatically shook out a raincoat with his left hand, just as he handed off a package to Smith with his right. Karamasinas saw the raincoat, but not the package. Smith had learned this technique from a professional magician. The next day, Helms approved the use of the brush pass in Prague. The Czech agent subsequently passed to the CIA hundreds of rolls of film. The brush pass, with modifications, was later expanded into all of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. The younger generation adapted as they went along. David Forden, a case officer who had been tutored by Smith, went to Warsaw and invented a technique using a slowly moving car to slip around corners in the gap and exchange packages with agents. It was sort of a brush pass using the car. "I submitted a proposal for what I thought was a valuable tradecraft tool to meet people in areas which were heavy in surveillance against American spies," Forden recalled. "I got a response from the front office of the division. Risky, dangerous, won't work." To which I replied, "Look, all this is risky and dangerous, but it will work." Forden later became the case officer for one of the CIA's most productive and significant agents, Ryszard Kuklinski, a Polish army colonel who provided critical intelligence on the Warsaw Pact. Gerber experimented with an even more radical idea than the brush pass, meeting with an agent personally. The brush pass was a very swift transaction while under surveillance. Gerber's ambition was to bring off a real meeting with the agent away from surveillance. Headquarters was aghast, but Gerber thought he could make it work during his next assignment to Sofia, Bulgaria. The personal meetings wouldn't be long, and Gerber thought they could be managed with care. A written message, passed in a dead drop, was limited to what was on the page. But in person, Gerber could look in the eyes of the agent, ask a question, absorb the body language and the mood. He also concluded that being a case officer and a station chief meant taking calculated risks. Espionage required going out on a limb. Gerber's enthusiasm for meeting agents in person never dimmed. In the first years of the Cold War, the dearth of human source intelligence from inside the Soviet Union forced the United States to turn instead to technology and American strength. First with the U-2 spy plane in the 1950s, and then with satellites known as Corona, Gambit, and Hexagon, launched in the 1960s and 1970s, overhead photography and signals intelligence opened vast new spying vistas. The most advanced satellite system, Hexagon, was capable of photographing 80 to 90% of the built-up areas of the Soviet Union twice a year, and a single Hexagon swath covered an area 345 by 8,055 miles. For American decision-makers, the satellites were a godsend for tracking strategic weapons and a bulwark against surprise. But how to steal secrets inside the vaults in the minds of people, the secrets that a satellite could not see? The CIA groped for effective techniques to spot, recruit, and run agents against the Soviet target. At one point, an internal CIA study proposed looking for outliers, misfits, and the psychologically troubled among Soviet diplomats. Another theory was that a new generation of spoiled younger people, the Soviet golden youth, would be more likely to become agents or defect. A third idea, offered by a CIA psychologist, was to pursue those who had marriage difficulties or who felt frustrated in their work, personally insulted, or blocked in some way. Gerber, back at headquarters by 1971, never believed in a single formula. Rather, he emphasized pragmatism. Find out who has the secrets and build bridges to them. What works, works, he often said. But Gerber also knew that the CIA, burdened by the legacy of suspicion, was not particularly welcoming to volunteers in Moscow. Those Russians who dared show up at the embassy would usually be asked a few questions and shown the door. Rarely was there an effort to find out if they were genuine. Angleton's influence cast a long shadow. With a small staff and acting entirely on his own hunch, Gerber began a systematic study, pulling the files of every person who had volunteered information in Moscow going back a decade and a half, and in Eastern Europe, a decade. He yanked the dossiers and cable traffic, scrutinizing every scrap. Taken together, the files seemed to shout that Angleton was wrong to have such blanket suspicions. It appeared to Gerber that the CIA had been routinely turning away genuine volunteers, throwing away what might be valuable intelligence. He concluded that it would be far more productive to check out those who offered their services, rather than assume all were part of some KGB deception plot. He felt the CIA ought to be smart enough in Moscow to sift the genuine sources from the fake ones. Also, he noticed a pattern. Those volunteers whom the KGB used as dangles, a trap, were usually already known to the intended recipients, perhaps someone they might have met once or twice before. That's how the KGB worked. To snare someone, they set out bait that would be recognized, to sugarcoat the trap. In the files, Gerber found there were also patterns for the kinds of people the KGB would not use in a trap. They had never offered up a serving KGB staff officer. They just didn't trust their own to go off in a relationship with an American case officer. They also didn't use someone who was a stranger to the recipient. Gerber's conclusion: don't be afraid to accept something from a person you've never seen before. It is probably not dangerous. It might be useless, but probably not dangerous. However, Gerber thought, if a Soviet acquaintance seems eager to thrust an envelope into your hands, be careful. It may well be a deception. These conclusions came to be known at the CIA as the Gerber Rules and marked a turning point. They upended the Angleton thinking. Not every volunteer was a dangle. Gerber wrote a report on his conclusions in May 1971. Helms had finally had enough of Angleton's influence and appointed a new Soviet division chief to clean house. The new chief was David Blee, a veteran of the OSS who had been dropped behind enemy lines in World War II and later joined the CIA at its founding in 1947. Blee, who came across as mild and austere, an old-school intelligence officer who was station chief in South Africa, Pakistan, and India, and later chief of the Near East Division, had never had any experience with the Soviet Union. And that is just what Helms needed. Someone who was not part of the Angleton fog of suspicion. Blee put out the word. The time had come to get serious about opening the mail inside the Soviet Union. Angleton was forced to retire in December 1974, but even before he left headquarters, a new era was dawning. The more aggressive approach began to pay off. That January, the CIA had recruited a Soviet diplomat, then serving in Bogota, Colombia. Alexander Ogorodnik was the son of a high-ranking Soviet naval officer, 38 years old. Tall and attractive, with an athletic build and dark hair. Ogorodnik was serving as an economics officer in Bogota. He had plenty of problems. He was under pressure by the KGB to be an informer, a role he did not want but was afraid to refuse. He was married but had a Colombian mistress. He had purchased a car which was unusual for a Soviet diplomat, and he seemed to enjoy the high life around town. He also needed money. A CIA officer made a pitch to Ogorodnik in a Turkish bath in a large downtown hotel in Bogota. Ogorodnik didn't hesitate and said yes. He told the officer he loathed the KGB and wanted to change the Soviet system. But his motivation was also personal. He wanted to be paid handsomely. He agreed to let the CIA keep most of his salary in escrow, but he used some of it to purchase emerald jewelry for his mother and modest luxuries for himself, such as contact lenses, which were unobtainable at the time in the Soviet Union. With gusto, Ogorodnik plunged into spy training in Bogota. Normally, according to a former high-ranking CIA official, such operational training would take months of study and years to perfect, but Ogorodnik mastered it all in a matter of weeks. He learned how to photograph documents, at first with a 35mm camera, and later with a new CIA miniature camera, known as the T-50. The tiny camera was concealed inside a large fountain pen. The film in the T-50 was not very light-sensitive. The camera needed strong light on the documents and to be held very steady. One day, Ogorodnik had a surprising announcement for his CIA handlers. The Soviet embassy had received a top-secret policy paper on China that could be read only in a closed room inside the KGB offices. Twice, Ogorodnik tried to take the fountain pen into the room, but he could not escape the watchful gaze of the guard. Finally, he appeared at the hotel room door and declared to his CIA tutor, "I think I've got it." The CIA man rushed the camera to a waiting courier, who carried it by hand on a plane to headquarters at Langley, Virginia. The camera had captured all but 2 of the 50 pages. Ogorodnik was transferred back to Moscow in 1974, putting him in an even better position to become an agent for the United States. He told the CIA he had just one request, a suicide pill, in case he was caught. The CIA was reluctant, and Ogorodnik flew home to Moscow without the pill. But he did carry a book. Concealed inside was a schedule and instructions for communications with the CIA. The CIA was finding its way out of the wilderness of mirrors. Ogorodnik was the first agent of this new period, but he would not be the last. Chapter 2. Moscow Station. Marty Peterson led a stressful double life in Moscow. At the U.S. Embassy, she worked in a busy staff job, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. The embassy employed dozens of Soviet workers, and Peterson was side by side with 8 of them, all women, potential KGB informants. Peterson did her work well, showed up on time, and after hours went out with other single men and women from the embassy staff. Everything in her apartment, clothes, purses, shoes, shopping bags, letters from home, music, and books, was that of a young American embassy worker. But at midday, she would often slip away, saying she was going to lunch, and spend an hour in the CIA's Moscow station typing up a report or preparing an operation. At night and on weekends, she checked and photographed rendezvous sites, delivered and retrieved agent packages, handled electronic gear to communicate with spies, and kept a constant watch for any sign that the KGB might know what she was doing. Her life was an exhausting split screen. She maintained the routines of a normal embassy staffer by day, while carrying a full load for the CIA the rest of the time. The two roles had to be separate. The first, convincing. The second, invisible. Peterson was the first woman to serve as a case officer in the Moscow station. She had been hand-picked by the station chief, Robert Fulton, who calculated that the KGB would overlook a woman because they used only men in such roles. Fulton, then 49 years old, had devoted his career to the shadow war against communism. He served in the Korean War as a military intelligence officer and joined the CIA in 1955. His assignments later included espionage operations in Finland, Denmark, Vietnam, Thailand, and the Soviet Union. Spying was his life. He was a pillar of support for Peterson, waiting patiently in the station during the lunch hour for her to show up from her cover job, always attentive, and coaching her on her tradecraft. He had a sparkle in his eye and never took himself too seriously. When she got to Moscow in 1975, Peterson was 30 years old and was just emerging from her own private hell of grief and uncertainty. In her 20s, she had accompanied her husband, John Peterson, to Laos, where he was running CIA paramilitary operations during the Vietnam War. On October 19, 1972, John was killed when his helicopter was shot down. The loss crushed her, and for a while she felt adrift, pained by the anti-war protests in the United States. Eventually, she decided to follow in John's footsteps and joined the CIA in 1973. She was the daughter of a Connecticut businessman with a liberal arts education, a product of the Cold War years, with strong memories of air raid drills in school. She was motivated more by a can-do spirit than by an ideology. When a friend suggested she go into clandestine operations, she seized the chance. Peterson was attractive and single, and Fulton had guessed correctly. On her arrival in Moscow, the KGB failed to detect she was an intelligence officer. The Moscow station was a cramped box of a room on the 7th floor of the embassy, the only place Peterson could be herself. Outside, she had to live her cover, and the rules were strict. She could not even share a cup of coffee in the cafeteria with the other CIA people, nor socialize with them, because there were Soviet employees all around who might inform the KGB. Once safely inside the station, she could relax, unwind, and talk openly. She took the CIA's training courses before leaving the United States, practicing such things as how to put down a message for an agent, using a beanbag tossed from a moving car at the Hecht department store parking garage in Northern Virginia. Her beanbags hit the target, but real operations were far more difficult and stressful. Her first weeks in Moscow were spent learning the streets, driving her boxy Ziguli car all over the city, often accompanied by a female friend. A small CIA-built radio receiver allowed case officers to monitor KGB surveillance broadcasts while on the street. Peterson heard nothing. The men in the station envied her ability to move around unfettered. Peterson realized that some suspected she just didn't see the surveillance. She was determined to prove herself, but at the same time suffered her own insecurities. Could it be that she didn't see the KGB was watching her from the window of an apartment building? Or maybe it was the policeman up in the bird's nest on the boulevard intersection. It would have been much easier to just give in and say yes, that she was under surveillance, than to keep trying to prove there was none. But she saw none, and that's what she told them. Peterson often used John's Nikon SLR camera with a wide-angle lens to photograph sites for possible dead drops or clandestine meetings. No one on the street ever asked her what she was doing. When Peterson arrived at the Moscow station, the Ogorodnik operation was already in full swing. The spy had been given a code name, CK Trigon. The CK was a digraph that indicated the Soviet division. When Ogorodnik left Bogota and returned to Moscow, he drew an assignment in the Soviet Foreign Ministry. It wasn't at a high level, but it gave him direct access to secret cables arriving from and going out to Soviet embassies around the world. For the CIA, that was just perfect. After a delay, Ogorodnik provided a steady stream of secret documents from the Foreign Ministry. He mastered the T-50, and his photographs were always in focus and proper alignment. He followed procedures agreed on in Bogota and made signals to the CIA by parking his car between 7 and 7:15 p.m. in front of his mother's apartment building. Once, when Ogorodnik signaled he was ready to deliver a package, Fulton went to collect it himself. Calmly, he put his dog Goliath in the car and set off for a forest on a wooded hill overlooking the city near Moscow State University. As Fulton drove there, he saw the KGB surveillance team lazily tailing him. He often walked his dog in the woods, so they did not suspect anything unusual. When Fulton opened his car door, the dog suddenly bounded into the forest of birches and pines, Fulton chasing him. The dog urinated on a tree, precisely where the package had been left. Fulton quickly snatched it up and stuffed it into his coat pocket before the KGB could see what was happening. He took it home, but did not open it, suspecting the KGB might have a video camera in his apartment. The next morning, it was opened in the station. It contained 10 rolls of film and a note. In 1976, fresh signs of difficulty cropped up. Ogorodnik inexplicably missed signals in February and March. Then in April, Peterson was assigned to fill a dead drop, her first operational act in Moscow. The package was to be placed at the foot of a light pole on a cold and snowy evening. Carefully constructed by the CIA technical operations officers, the package looked like a crushed cigarette pack, but inside were a miniature camera, rolls of film, and a message. Peterson deftly laid down the package as she simultaneously pretended to pause to blow her nose and adjust her boot. Cold and anxious, she walked on for an hour, following the plan agreed to earlier in the Moscow station, then returned to the site to see if the package had been retrieved. It was still there. Ogorodnik had not come. She picked it up and headed home, uncertain and worried. When Peterson went on another foray on June 21st, she was carrying the most important package the CIA had ever prepared for Ogorodnik, the suicide pill he requested. Concealed inside a large hollowed-out log created by the CIA was a handsome black fountain pen with a cyanide fluid capsule inside, and another pen, identical on the outside, with the T-50 miniature camera inside. The cyanide cartridge in the pen was fragile and could easily be crushed by biting down on it. Peterson had cradled the hollowed-out log under her arm, set it down near a lamppost in a wooded area, and left the spot. Then, Ogorodnik arrived, picked it up, and left behind what looked like a crumpled milk carton smeared with mustard plaster, to resemble vomit and deter anyone from picking it up. An hour and a half later, Peterson returned to the lamppost, scooped up the milk carton, slipped it quickly into a plastic bag in her purse, and walked to a nearby bus shelter. She was elated. The next step was to put a thin red line with lipstick on the bus shelter to signal Ogorodnik that she had recovered his package. But in her excitement, she pressed too hard. The lipstick smashed in her fist and left a red blob. She felt a rush of adrenaline from the successful exchange, but a hollow sensation, too. While walking, Peterson had a lot of time to think about Ogorodnik. She had never met him in person. He had to feel terribly alone. She wondered if he feared arrest. Would he find the courage to use the suicide pill? Would he mistakenly think the end was near and commit suicide prematurely? Later in 1976, in a moment of panic, when he thought he was under suspicion, Ogorodnik threw out his pen with the cyanide capsule. He asked for another. Peterson prepared to deliver it again at the same site, in a hollowed-out log. But this time, an hour before he was supposed to pick it up in the forest, Peterson saw Ogorodnik drive by in his car, just as she approached the park. She knew it was his car by the license plate. But what really unnerved her was the sight of a woman with a ponytail on the passenger side. Who was she? Peterson found a remote spot and hid in the woods, tense and motionless. At the proper hour, Ogorodnik came by, alone, carrying a briefcase, and picked up the log, ponytail was nowhere to be seen. When work got stressful in the long, dark winter months, Peterson sought release in cross-country skiing in the forests outside the city. The Moscow station had selected a dead-drop site for Ogorodnik in the forest. He had signaled that he was ready to drop a package on Saturday, January 29, 1977, at 9 a.m. The site was near a boulder. Peterson had seen a sketch of the location. On the morning of the drop, a blizzard covered Moscow. Peterson drove out to the country, seeing almost no one, parked her car, and slipped through the forest on her skis. The boulder, as big as a Volkswagen, was buried in snow. She had hoped to see Ogorodnik's footprints, but the snow was as pristine as white sugar icing. No trace of anyone. Peterson hunted for the package, but couldn't find it. She was certain it must be there. Perhaps Ogorodnik left it on the wrong side of the rock. She started digging and found nothing. Growing frantic, she uncovered and sifted through every bit of snow around the boulder. There was no package. Peterson went home, worried and exhausted. Earlier in January, Fulton, the station chief, was filling up his car at a gas station used by diplomats and other foreigners in Moscow. It was a small pavilion with pumps out front and a Russian sign, "No smoking." Fulton was just getting back into his car at 6 p.m., and at least five vehicles were waiting behind him. People were standing around, talking. As Fulton opened the car door, a man walked up to him. The man spoke in English. "Are you American? I would like to talk to you." Fulton had not noticed the man until he actually spoke. Fulton said it would be difficult to talk right there and asked him what he wanted. "Oh, it would be difficult," the man said, his words stilted as if he had expected that was what Fulton would say. Switching to Russian, the man said, "Excuse me," leaned slightly into the car, and put a folded piece of paper on the seat. Fulton realized that the man had been holding the note in his palm and seemed to have given some thought to what he was doing. The exchange lasted no more than 15 seconds. The man walked away from the gas station and turned down a side street. Fulton headed back to the Moscow station and saw no one following him. Once safely in the station, Fulton examined the note. It was written in Russian on both sides of a single sheet of white paper, folded up within a second sheet that was blank. Fulton sent a cable to CIA headquarters, describing the man in his late 50s or early 60s, about 5 feet 6 inches, 175 pounds, dressed as an average Soviet, wearing dark overcoat and fur hat. Fulton reported that his car was the only one with license plates indicating he was an American in the gas station at that time. In the abbreviated style of such cables, Fulton added that the man was obviously waiting for American to show up. The man appeared in no way to be nervous, and obviously had approach well thought out. In the note, the man said he wanted to discuss matters on a strictly confidential basis with an appropriate American official. The note said nothing about who he was or what he wanted to talk about, but he sketched out a detailed plan for the next step, suggesting either meeting at a metro stop, the underground subway, or in a car. Fulton was apprehensive. It was not unusual for Soviet citizens to give notes to Americans, and many American diplomats who left car windows open a crack in the summer found messages slip through them. But Fulton had learned to be careful. The KGB often attempted to lure CIA officers with dangles. Sometimes the trap was so crude it could easily be dismissed, but others were harder to detect. The KGB had a long history of skillful deceptions. They would lure a CIA officer to a meeting. Then the officer would be ambushed, declared persona non grata, and expelled. Every move of the Moscow station was coordinated with headquarters. Fulton told headquarters that the note from the man at the gas station conveyed a carefully thought-out plan for a meeting but provided few details. The note is conspiratorial, which might suggest some intel background, he wrote. Fulton said he was very much aware the approach could be a KGB dangle, and he would like to have a better idea of what the man wanted. Fulton said he would signal to the man that he was interested in the car option, but not hold a personal meeting just yet. If the man was a dangle, Fulton did not want to put his foot into a trap. But Fulton was also intrigued. The note had a ring of authenticity to it. Fulton thought if he took the first step, perhaps the man would come back with more information. He drove his car to the spot the man had mentioned, but he didn't see the man anywhere. Later, CIA headquarters said that they did not want to pursue the contact, fearing it was a trap, and instructed Fulton to do nothing more. On February 3rd, the man appeared again. This time, he approached Fulton's car on a street very close to the embassy at 7 p.m., after dark. Fulton happened at that moment to be sitting in his car with the engine running. There was a Soviet militia post nearby, but the car was obscured by a high snowbank along the street. The man's face appeared at the driver's side window, and he tapped on it. When Fulton rolled down the window, the man dropped a note into the car. He then turned and left. No one was following him. The note again proposed a signal and a meeting. The man said the signal should be delivered on the next evening by parking the car on a nearby street. Fulton sent a cable to headquarters, saying the man's motives were still not clear, so he did not respond. 2 weeks later, on February 17th, Fulton left the embassy around 6:45 p.m., and as he approached his car, noticed the man leave a phone booth that was nestled in the shadows of an apartment building, about 30 feet away. Fulton was climbing into the car when the man approached him. "What do you want?" Fulton asked. The man said he wanted to give Fulton another note. He tossed a folded letter into the car, turned on his heel, and quickly left. Fulton saw no one around, got in his car, and calmly drove home. He saw no one following him. When he opened the letter, Fulton found four handwritten pages. He sent a rough translation to headquarters the next morning. The man wrote that he realized why his repeated requests were being ignored. "My activities may have brought suspicion," he said, adding that he understood full well the CIA was fearful of being trapped by the KGB. But, the man added, if he had wanted to do that, he could have done so already. This was not his intent or his method. "I'm an engineer and not a specialist in secret matters," he said, promising to provide more information about himself to dispel the mistrust, but urging the CIA to handle his next message very carefully. "I work in a closed enterprise," he said, which meant a secret Soviet facility, probably related to defense or military work. In order to pass notes, the man wrote, he had been waiting for hours at more than one location to find just the right moment, a time-consuming and stressful vigil. He implored the CIA to make it easier and to show up for his next note on the following Friday. Fulton asked CIA headquarters for permission to go ahead. He was impressed by the man's tenacity. He told headquarters that the risk wasn't great to park his car on the street and wait for the man to thrust an envelope through the window. "The man has essentially already done this twice," he said, "and the KGB could have ambushed them earlier if they had wanted to." Fulton realized there would be doubts at headquarters. They might well ask, wasn't it rather unlikely that a Russian man in Moscow, without any help at all, would have singled out the CIA's station chief to deliver a note. At the time of the first note in January, the United States had just expelled a KGB officer at the United Nations. Could this be the setup for retaliation? Still, something about the man led Fulton to think he was genuine. Fulton told headquarters he believed the man had chosen him by coincidence at the diplomatic gas station and probably memorized the car's license number, and thus it was not unusual that he would continue to seek him out. Fulton said he would, under no circumstances, proceed to other sites that could be a trap. Headquarters was wary and told Fulton not to give the man a signal. Just a few months later, in May 1977, the man approached Fulton for the fourth time. He had been hiding in a phone booth near Fulton's car and was carrying a package. Fulton saw KGB guards nearby, so he did not take the package. The man banged on Fulton's car to get his attention. Fulton ignored him, as headquarters instructed. By the summer, Fulton's tour was over. The new chief of the Moscow station was Gardener Gus Hathaway, who brought a different style. He had grown up in Southern Virginia and never lost his slight accent, with its gentle rolling R's, or his gentleman's manners, which combined with a powerful sense of mission. Hathaway, 53 years old, served in Berlin for the CIA in the late 1950s and later in Latin America, and had a hard-charging way about him, a zeal for operations. All through the spring and early summer of 1977, the Moscow station struggled with setbacks in the Ogorodnik case. A hollow log was left for Ogorodnik in February, but he did not show up. He emplaced a dead drop on schedule in April, but when the station's technical officers opened it, they concluded it was put together by someone else. His photography, usually perfect, seemed careless. Hathaway wanted to recontact Ogorodnik and get the operation back on track. The CIA sent the agent a message by a coded shortwave radio broadcast, instructing him to leave a signal with a small red mark on a children crossing traffic sign if he was ready for another dead drop. Early on the morning of July 15, 1977, Peterson drove by the sign, and the mark was there, but something didn't look right. It was bold, cherry red, as if it had been deliberately stenciled. A real agent doesn't have time to stencil a signal like that. She went to the station and told the others what she had seen. The signal was there, yes, but it seemed odd. Peterson suggested that someone else place the next drop. She had a knot in her stomach. The stenciled mark should have made Hathaway more cautious, but it didn't. He was eager to keep going. That day, Peterson worked her usual day hours at her cover job. At 6 p.m., she went to the station and reviewed the operations plan at the small conference table in Hathaway's office. Then she went home, changed into comfortable clothes, a summer blouse and platform sandals. She pulled back her hair to conceal the blonde streaks. She would never look like a Russian, but she wanted to blend in as much as possible. She attached a tiny CIA radio receiver that detected KGB transmissions to her bra with Velcro. She connected the neck loop antenna and then inserted a very small wireless earpiece, entirely concealed by her hair. By car, she went on a long, winding surveillance detection run around town, designed to flush out any KGB monitors. She parked her car, entered the subway, changed at three stations, and exited at the sports stadium, just as a crowd was leaving a soccer game. She slipped into the crowd, finally arriving at the site for the dead drop, located in a small stone tower on a railroad bridge spanning the Moscow River. She walked up 40 stairs to a point on the bridge where she had left packages for Ogorodnik before. In her bag was a piece of crumbly black asphalt that had a hidden compartment inside holding messages and a miniature camera for Ogorodnik. At 10:15 p.m., barely dusk in Moscow during the summer, Peterson left the chunk of black asphalt in a narrow square window in the stone tower of the bridge, pushing it exactly one arm's length from the edge. She began to descend the steps when she saw three men in white shirts rushing toward her. She had nowhere to escape and wasn't about to jump into the river. Grabbed by the men, she felt a jolt of anger that it was the KGB. A van pulled up, and more men clambered out. Peterson kicked one of them hard, but they restrained her. The KGB officer began to take flash pictures. Then, groping her, they discovered the radio receiver, but didn't know how to peel apart the Velcro. Next, they produced the black asphalt chunk they found in the tower. Peterson insisted loudly that she was an American citizen. They should call the embassy. They could not detain her. "Let me go," she shouted. One of the KGB men said, "Please keep your voice down." Peterson kept repeating the embassy phone number. Finally, they got the radio receiver off the bra and found the neck loop. However, they never discovered the small wireless earpiece. Peterson was taken to KGB headquarters, the Lubyanka, and interrogated. She had a sinking feeling when they brought out the asphalt chunk, removed the four reverse-threaded screws, took off the lid to the hidden cavity, and emptied it in front of her, a technician pulling out each item as the interrogator watched. There was a message for Ogorodnik imprinted in tiny letters on 35mm film, contact lenses and fluid, rolls of tightly wound rubles, and emerald jewelry. When the big black fountain pen was pulled out, the chief interrogator sharply instructed the technician to put it down and not touch it. His tone suggested that he was aware of the cyanide capsule the CIA had given to Ogorodnik. In fact, Peterson knew this pen concealed a camera, not the cyanide capsule. But she realized very quickly, by the interrogator's manner, that Ogorodnik had been caught. She was released later that night, the usual procedure in espionage arrests. The embassy's consular affairs officer came to get her. His eyes were wide with disbelief. He thought she had been a bureaucrat, not a case officer on the streets. The consular affairs officer drove her to the embassy, and Peterson went immediately to the Moscow station, knowing that shortly she would be declared persona non grata in the Soviet Union. Over the next few hours, well past midnight, sitting in the middle of the station, she recounted the events, sometimes with profanity, as her colleagues listened, and one of them took notes for a cable back to headquarters. The cable was sent out at 3:30 a.m., Moscow time. Sad, exhausted, and uncertain about how Ogorodnik had been discovered, Peterson had little sleep before she flew out of Moscow the next day, Saturday, July 16th. At headquarters, it was a crushing blow. Ogorodnik was a prized agent, the first to show the Angleton years had finally been left behind. He had been lost, and no one knew why. James Olson, a case officer, recalled the scene at headquarters soon after word reached the Soviet desk. "The entire USSR desk, from the lowest clerk to the crusty old chief, were all crying," Olson remembered. "It was because we lost Trigon. We knew Trigon was gone." Peterson later learned that Ogorodnik had been arrested at his apartment. He was stripped to his underwear. Knowing the KGB would be eager to learn every detail of his work with the CIA, he offered to write a confession. They handed him his pen, and he bit down on the barrel with the cyanide capsule inside. He died on the spot, before the KGB could learn any more. Chapter 3. A Man Called Sphere. On the long trip home, Marty Peterson struggled with the unanswered questions. She didn't know why the case had fallen apart. Her surveillance detection run had been long and thorough, and she had seen no signs of the KGB. Yet they were lying in wait at the bridge. Even after they grabbed her, they still didn't know she was CIA. She had eluded them for 2 years. So how did they figure out the precise time and place for the dead drop? Was there a slip-up? Was there surveillance she didn't see? A communications leak? Did Ogorodnik make a mistake? Or something worse? Peterson left Moscow quickly in the clothes she was wearing the night of the ambush. In Washington, she bought a new dress. On Monday, July 18th, less than 72 hours after the debacle in Moscow, she walked up the steps to the main entrance of CIA headquarters at Langley. In her new identification photograph taken that morning, she is smiling, a bit hesitantly, her eyes clear and bright. The debriefings revived the same questions she had asked herself about Ogorodnik's missed meetings, the deteriorating quality of his photographs, the inexplicable events in the forest, and the woman with the ponytail. Then, in a corridor at headquarters, she saw Fulton, her mentor, for the first time since he had left the Moscow station. They embraced and fought back tears, no words to speak the sorrow they felt. On the 7th floor of CIA headquarters, Peterson entered the large office suite of Admiral Stansfield Turner, the new director of Central Intelligence, who after 4 months in the job was still finding his way. Turner had a very forceful public presence, but in private he was cordial and reserved. He sat down at the head of a long conference table, dismissed the CIA officer who had brought Peterson, and motioned to her to take a chair at his right. After she recounted everything that had happened, Turner asked her to accompany him to meet President Jimmy Carter at his regular briefing the next day. There would only be 9 or 10 minutes to tell her story. On Tuesday, they entered the Oval Office. On the coffee table in front of Carter, Peterson placed a replica of the black asphalt chunk used to hold the secret messages for Ogorodnik and the CIA's site sketches to help illustrate what happened. The president was engrossed by her account. At one point, the National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, spoke up, filling in details, such as the name of the agent, Ogorodnik, and the name of the Moscow Railroad Bridge where she had been ambushed. Brzezinski, whose father had been a Polish aristocrat and diplomat in the anti-communist Polish government before World War II, devoted his career as a professor to chronicling the decline of Soviet communism. He knew perhaps better than anyone in the room how valuable and unusual this spy had been. "I greatly admire your courage," Brzezinski told Peterson as she was leaving. 10 minutes had stretched to more than 20. Peterson left the Oval Office alone and had to ask a White House secretary how to find her way out to the street. Later that day, Turner sent her a breezy handwritten thank you note. "You are the only person who has stood face to face with the KGB and the President of the United States, all within 3 days," he said. "I admire and congratulate you." But privately, Turner was brooding about her expulsion. The events in Moscow meant something was wrong. Stansfield Turner grew up in Highland Park, Illinois, an affluent small town on the lakeshore north of Chicago, with stately homes and tree-lined streets. His father, Oliver, was a self-made businessman who filled the house with books. His mother drilled into him values of honesty and integrity. Turner became an Eagle Scout and president of his high school class, went on to Amherst College, and after a lobbying campaign by his father, won admission to the U.S. Naval Academy. When he graduated in June 1946, Turner stood at 25th in a class of 841. He was at the top of the class in aptitude for service, qualities of leadership, integrity, reliability, and other traits of a superior officer. But Turner chafed at the academy's courses, heavily oriented toward engineering, seamanship, and science. His interests ran far beyond. Rather than plunge immediately into a Navy career, Turner won a prestigious Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford University, where he studied politics, philosophy, and economics. On returning to the Navy, Turner went to sea on destroyers, but was impatient with the minutiae of shipboard life. He wanted to think big and be at the center of change. In the 1950s, he was selected by a new chief of naval operations, Arleigh Burke, to put together a group of junior officers to tell Burke what was wrong with the Navy and how to fix it, an assignment Turner found exhilarating. Then Turner was selected to work with the Whiz Kids under Robert McNamara in the 1960s, when systems analysis was all the rage. When Admiral Elmo Zumwalt became the new chief of naval operations in 1970, he put Turner in charge of new initiatives in his first 60 days. Through it all, Turner became convinced the military was hidebound and desperately needed new thinking. He once used systems analysis to study naval minesweeping and showed how it could be done better and faster from a helicopter than from a ship. Yet Turner's zeal for change often ran headlong into inertia, especially in the Vietnam War years, when military morale and discipline were sapped by defeat and a loss of support at home. Appointed commander of the Naval War College in 1972, Turner seized the opportunity to overhaul the curriculum, making it more rigorous and demanding. Through all his assignments, he preached the virtues of discipline and accountability. Turner's class at the U.S. Naval Academy included a somewhat shy and skinny fellow from a backwater peanut farm in Georgia, Jimmy Carter, who also applied for a Rhodes Scholarship but did not get it. Carter stood at 59th in the class. Carter and Turner did not know each other then. Carter went on to become a nuclear submariner, farmer, and governor of Georgia. In 1973, Turner invited Carter to speak at the War College and was impressed. The following year, in October 1974, they met again at Carter's offices in Atlanta. Carter fired rapid questions at Turner for half an hour about the state of the U.S. military and the Navy. When it was over, Carter said, "By the way, the day after tomorrow, I'm announcing that I'm going to run for President of the United States." Carter triumphed in the 1976 presidential campaign by emphasizing trust to a nation battered by the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal. He projected a fresh moralistic approach to government, "I'll never tell a lie," and a break with the sordid scandals in Washington. Among them, in Carter's view, were the disclosures, starting in late 1974, of illegal CIA surveillance of American citizens, including anti-war activists. Three separate investigations of the CIA followed over the next 16 months, revealing more unsavory operations. When Carter took office in January 1977, the CIA was still reeling from these probes. The agency had three directors in 4 years. The outgoing director, George H.W. Bush, a Republican appointed by President Ford, was affable and well-liked at the CIA, and he wanted to remain. But Carter demanded a clean break. Carter at first chose Theodore Sorensen, the Kennedy speechwriter and a Democratic lawyer, to lead the CIA. But Sorensen withdrew when it was disclosed he had once been a conscientious objector, and opposition to the nomination mounted in Congress. At the time, Turner had become a four-star admiral and was serving as commander-in-chief of Allied forces in southern Europe. When Turner first got the call to come to Washington, he hoped he was being considered for a military appointment as chief of naval operations or vice chief. At the White House, Carter greeted Turner warmly in his private office, then asked him to head the CIA. Turner was not ready for this, and protested that he might be better in a military position. But Turner quickly grasped that Carter had made up his mind. In fact, it was Turner's military career and reputation for discipline and integrity that appealed to the new president, who had promised to turn a new leaf at the CIA. Turner took the CIA job, but "I walked out in a real daze." In the early months in office, Turner and Carter were both fascinated by stunning advances in technology, such as the revolutionary KH-11 satellite that transmitted electronic images directly to the ground rather than using the cumbersome previous method, in which film canisters were ejected from a satellite and captured by airplanes on descent. The KH-11 images could be seen in real time instead of days or weeks later. By coincidence, the first images were received at the CIA just hours before Carter was inaugurated president. The next day, Carter was shown the photographs in the White House Situation Room. "It was a marvelous system," Turner later recalled, "much like a TV in space that sent back pictures almost instantly." Turner saw the technical side of intelligence collection as the wave of the future. He wanted intelligence that could be delivered when it was needed. As CIA director, Turner took home draft national intelligence estimates on weekends and marked them up with red pencil. The estimates are the highest product of finished intelligence that the CIA provides to decision-makers in government, reflecting the results of espionage as well as analysis, and they are usually created and polished by dozens of officials before being disseminated. It was unheard of for a director to take them home and personally edit them. Separately, Turner displayed an independent streak in his thinking about the world and a fondness for analysis of it. He strongly questioned the U.S. military's gloomy estimates of the expanding Soviet military threat. This deeply irritated the Pentagon, but Turner insisted that aspects of American strength were far superior and should be taken into account. He wanted a genuine balance sheet, not just a catalog of the latest Soviet threats. However, Turner was singularly unprepared for the risky world of running spies. Espionage meant persuading people to betray their country and to steal secrets. Unlike most other agencies in the U.S. government, the CIA's purpose was to violate the laws of other countries. In the clandestine service, the people who engaged in this practice believed they served a noble cause. Turner never understood them, and they saw him as distant and aloof. Robert Gates, who served for a while as Turner's executive assistant, recalled that the cultural and philosophical gap between Turner and the clandestine service was simply too wide to be bridged. Turner said he wanted the CIA to have a higher ethical standard and efficient structure, like a corporation. But people in the clandestine service were put off by his preaching and moralism. Their work was often dirty and ruthless. They also resented how one of Turner's coterie of assistants, Robert "Rusty" Williams, went poking into private lives, asking about affairs and divorces, which were common in the high-stress world of operations. Also, in 1977, Turner eliminated hundreds of positions in the clandestine service. The cuts were overdue. The directorate was overstaffed from the Vietnam War, but Turner was brusque and maladroit in carrying them out. Many old-timers were offended, and resentments ran deep. "It was never quite convinced about human intelligence," recalled a CIA official who worked closely with Turner. "Sometimes it was good, and sometimes it was bad. He thought we got more out of technical intelligence. It was more reliable." Within weeks of his meeting with Marty Peterson in the Oval Office, Turner's suspicions deepened that something was wrong with the Moscow station. On the evening of August 26, 1977, Dick Combs, a political officer, was working late in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, writing a report. His office was on the same floor, the 7th, as the CIA station. A Marine guard burst into the office and asked Combs, "Do you smell smoke?" Combs had been puffing on a pipe, and did not, aside from his own. But he soon realized a fire was spreading across the 8th floor, just above him. It started after hours, when a transformer ignited in the economics section. The embassy had been a fire trap for years. A recent refurbishment used paneling that was highly flammable, and the Marine guards were unable to stop the flames with fire extinguishers. The Moscow Fire Department did not arrive immediately, and the first firemen on the scene seemed poorly trained, with outdated equipment and leaky hoses. The ambassador, Malcolm Toon, rushed to the building from a diplomatic dinner, still in black tie, and was on the street below, while the deputy chief of mission, Jack Matlock, hustled to the 9th floor. Matlock loved books and tried to save his library as the fire worsened. Later, more experienced firemen arrived, some of them KGB officers, certainly aware that the CIA's Moscow station was in the building, hoping to scoop up sensitive documents or enter classified areas. At one point, when it looked as if the entire building might be consumed in fire, the ambassador gave orders to find the CIA station chief, Hathaway, and order him to leave. A staffer found Hathaway guarding the station on the 7th floor, dressed in a London fog raincoat, his face smudged with soot, blocking the way for any KGB fireman who might try to break in. He refused to budge, despite the ambassador's order. How did the fire start? At headquarters, the CIA knew that the Soviets routinely bombarded the U.S. Embassy in Moscow with microwave signals. Turner brought this up constantly, saying he was worried about the beam.